the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, as you know, we've been looking through a series on Isaiah. And this week, we're looking at part of that section that Clive just read. Now, on Thursday, I was taking my son Ryan and his friend Matthew to a football practice. Now, Matthew goes to Clyst Vale Community College, and they had a mutual friend who's in the up-and-coming production of Les Miserables at the school. So I asked Matthew, I said, are you going to go and see it? Go and see your friend in the production? And he said, no way. And I was like, well, why not? Don't you like musicals? And he said, no, it's not that. So I just don't want to go and see people being miserable. I did go on to explain that that wasn't really what it was about. But you can see where his confusion came from. I wonder, what are we like with miserable people? Do we, as Christians, do we make each other feel guilty? If we're feeling fed up, if we're down, do we think we shouldn't feel like that as Christians? We should be full of joy. Do we deny how we feel? Do we go around with fake smiles saying, yeah, I'm fine, thanks, when actually we're hurting inside? Is this what Isaiah is doing in this passage? Is he saying, it's okay, we're about to be slaughtered by the evil Assyrians, but let's rejoice? Well, let's look a little closer at what he is actually saying. Now, last week, those of you who are here will remember that Paul from the Walk Through the Bible group gave an excellent summary about the history and the geography of the situation and really brought it to life with the imminent invasion of the evil Assyrians, who were over here where the band was, on their way to crush Judah. Now, here's a little map for those of you who like to look at things. And the green N and the green Z, that's the two areas that Isaiah mentions at the beginning. So Assyria were coming in, and they were coming to crush Judah. If we look at the end of chapter 8, Isaiah wrote, they will look towards the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness. But then chapter 9 begins, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom. Is Isaiah in denial? He's seeing his prediction. He's been predicting this darkness, hasn't he? Now he sees it begin to be fulfilled. But he stops now and responds with a prophecy of light. Now this darkness and distress were very real. The Assyrian army was on its way. They would be crushed. They would be defeated. But that wasn't the only reality. And in any situation, I think we can sink into despair, or we can choose to have faith and hope. Isaiah in this passage describes a hope. He explains this hope, and then he points to the fulfillment of this hope. He denies that gloom and anguish are the inevitable results of these events. But he does recognize the bitterness of the moment. But he focuses on a hope based on God's intervention. Now, this area of Naphtali and Zebulun, which we learned about last week, they were actually invaded twice by the Assyrians within the space of 5 years. The first time they were attacked, the second time they were attacked again, and then the Assyrian government set up 3 provinces. So where Isaiah describes them as Galilee of the Gentiles, the way of the sea, and along the Jordan. That's a really interesting choice of words. He calls it Galilee of the Gentiles. Now, there were some Gentiles living there, but there were also many Israelites. So why does he call it Galilee of the Gentiles? Well, he's emphasizing that the Savior is coming, not only for Israel, but for everybody. Israel had a choice in that moment, to look at the darkness, the hopelessness, the shattered dreams, and conclude that God had forgotten them, or to recall God's past mercies, to remember his promises, and to make great affirmations of hope. Now, Isaiah insists that that hope is a present reality. He goes on in the chapter to describe that hope. So this area that's been crushed twice by the Assyrians, it's been humbled, but in the future, it will be honoured. And it's interesting to see in Matthew chapter 4 that actually this is the very area where Jesus began his ministry, the very beginning of his time of preaching. In Matthew chapter 4, I'll just read it to you. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee. Leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near." The very area that had been crushed and defeated and humiliated was the area where Jesus began to preach and to teach. If we look at verse 2, it says the people were walking in darkness. They were living themselves in darkness. Now, if you remember from chapter 8, it said utter darkness. It's not just a bit of a grey day. This is utter darkness. They were under the rod of the oppressor. The Assyrian army were renowned for their atrocities. They could see the boots of the invading army coming again. It's very hard, isn't it, for us to imagine what that's like. I don't know if you've been watching the news recently and looking at what's been happening in Syria. With the siege of Bab al-Ahmar, there was no water, the city was bombarded, and now reports of atrocities are coming out. There's a report of one woman who was raped 12 times in one day. The 7,500 people, approximately, have been killed. We need to pray for that country and pray for the Christians in that country who are afraid of persecution. That's the kind of situation that Isaiah is writing into. But if you look, he writes as if this is a sure hope. He says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Now, English grammar is not my strong point, even though I do teach English. But here, even I can spot there's something strange happening with the tense of the verb. He is saying they have seen the light. The light has dawned. It's already happened. He's writing about the future as if it has already happened. I don't know if you're into rugby, but Colin's going on Saturday to see England play Ireland at Twickenham. Now, be a bit like Colin saying, well, all those people who go to watch the rugby on Saturday the 17th of March, they have seen Ireland win a great victory over England. It is a hope for Colin. It's probably not a sure hope. And obviously not what Phil Simmons would like to happen. But that's the style that Isaiah is writing in. He's saying this is so sure that this is going to happen. And if you look at the verbs, the people have seen the light and the light has dawned. God has made the light dawn and the people respond by seeing the light. So it's bringing God and people together. Now in the Bible, the light appearing, light is equated with God's presence. The light has appeared. The people aren't responsible for it, are they? They're groping around in the darkness. The darkness is what they deserve. Their actions, the actions of the king of Judah, have led to the darkness that they're suffering now. The people's sin and rebellion, though, are not enough to keep God from appearing to them. And that's incredibly encouraging, isn't it? Nothing we can ever do can keep us from God's love. It's an incredible encouragement. So the light appears. And what happens then? What is the result of this light appearing? The result is that joy overflows. Joy sweeps over the whole people. If we look at verse 3, instead of depopulation and dwindling away, the nation swells and grows. You, God, has enlarged the nation and increased their joy. Instead of a small harvest, it is an abundant harvest. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest. Instead of becoming spoil themselves, they will divide the spoils. This day of the ideal king promises deliverance from adversity, from natural circumstances, and deliverance from adversity of those inflicted by others. So these were all the fears of the people, the fears of natural world, the fears of the political world. It's encompassing everything, isn't it? They would have a growing population. They would have prosperity. They would have freedom. And all of this is from God. Despite their sin, despite their rebellion, it is all from God. What about us? What is the gloom in our lives? Thankfully, we're not a threat of imminent Assyrian invasion. But what about our work? Do we have insecurity in our jobs? Have we lost our jobs? Do we have so much pressure and stress at work? What about money? Bills are getting bigger and bigger. Higher prices, petrol, electricity. More and more families are thrust into debt. What about relationships? There's a very high divorce rate. Family breakdowns. More having to work more is leading to isolation. Less time for family and friends. What about illness, cancer, bereavement, death? What about our faith? Is our faith sidelined in the busyness of life? Has our relationship with God become subtly eroded? I was at a party last night, and there were a group of six of us. Only two of us are still married to our first husbands. The others were sitting around talking about how difficult life is, how they have to juggle looking after the children, finding a job, and in the meantime, trying to seek a new relationship. One of them turned to me and said, "Life shouldn't be this hard. Why is it this hard? Is this really all there is?" Do we have hope? Can we have this joy that God is with us? How can we do this? Well, Isaiah goes on to explain why he is so sure. He points them to history. If you look at verse 4, "For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor." Now you may remember from last week, Midian, the people that Gideon led God's army to defeat. Now Gideon is a fantastic story, isn't it? Where God raised up people to fight in battle. Gideon raised an army, I think, of about 30,000. And God said, "Nope, that's too many." And he whittled them down through various means and ended up taking 300 men into battle against a vast and superior army. But it was a fantastic portrayal of God's power. It was obviously God who won that battle. Obvious to everybody. Obvious to Gideon, the Israelites, and obvious to the Midians. God has shown himself completely capable of overcoming any enemy. And then the references to yoke and bar and rod is reference as well to Egypt, where they were oppressed and suffered as slaves. God brought them out of Egypt in a powerful demonstration, again, of his might and his power. Now, the Assyrian emperors delighted in telling how they imposed really heavy yokes on their captured people. And Isaiah is looking forward to this day when one mightier than the Assyrians will break that yoke and they will finally be defeated. If we look on to verse 5, "Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire." Now the word here used for boot is actually an Egyptian and Assyrian word. It's chosen to express the breaking of alien power with this alien word. These were burnt to stop wars from happening. There would be an end to all wars. Now you might think, well, if there's an end to wars, why aren't we burning the weapons? Why is he burning the boots? Well, he's stressing that everything will be destroyed, even the very boots that the soldiers wore. You can be sure that the weapons will be destroyed if care is taken even to burn the boots. And also the cloaks in whose fabric mix the blood of the conqueror and the conquered. These will be destroyed. In the future, there will be a release from oppression and an end to all war. I wonder, do we have moments that we remember in our lives? Every year, the Jewish people at Passover remember how God brought them out of Egypt. They remember his power, and that memory keeps them going in the difficult times. I wonder for us, do we have moments like that? Do we have moments when we say, oh, I remember when God helped me in that situation? And then that gives us the strength to go on through difficult times. Perhaps it's when you first became a Christian. Perhaps it's when you got baptized. Perhaps it's a powerful answer to prayer that you had. It's really important, isn't it, to remember those times, to even write them down and look at them continually and thank God for them. I know a friend of Colin's was working in Africa, and he woke up in the middle of the night one night and said, and just felt an overwhelming sense that he had to pray for his son. His son was living in America at the time. So he woke his wife up, which I'm sure she was very happy about, and said, we need to pray for our son. So they prayed and prayed and prayed. In the morning, they got a phone call, and he'd been in a horrific car accident. The car had been completely totaled, but he walked away fine, to the shock of all the police who were there on the scene. God protected him. And it was in such a powerful way, wasn't it, by making his parents wake up and pray for him at that exact moment. It was obvious to his parents and to him who had saved him. It wasn't a fluke, it wasn't luck, it was God's protection. I think in moments like that can encourage us and can help us. I recently read a book about a little boy in America who was involved in a car accident. The book is called The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. Now, I love reading books about how God's worked in people's lives, and this one's wonderful. And it just tells time and time again how God helped this poor family who struggled through many different things. And it's a very real book. They're not some kind of super spiritual family. They have arguments. They don't do the right thing. But God protects them and God helps them. So I recommend reading things like that to encourage us when we are going through difficult times to remember, who is this God that we serve? So how will this be realized, this hope that Isaiah has? It'll be realized by the ideal king being born. So how's God going to answer the might and oppression and coercion of the Assyrian Empire? With even greater aggression? No, with a tiny little child. God is strong enough, isn't he, to overcome his enemies by becoming vulnerable, transparent, and humble. God surprises us again. Just as with Gideon, he helped them to win a mighty victory with a tiny, tiny army. So he surprises again by bringing peace into the world through a child. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The son, Isaiah used the word son to stress that he will inherit the royal line. He's born of human parents, but he's also given from God. The government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, there's much debate among scholars about what these names mean, these four names. Some people have said, oh, well, it's just like Egyptians. When they crown a king, they give them throne names. And that's what Isaiah is doing here. Well, there's slight differences. In Egypt, they have five names. They gave five names to their kings. And the names were just related to gods. They would say things like, may he be enduring in kinship like Re in heaven, who was one of their gods. Egyptians also believed that kings were gods, but Israel definitely did not believe that their kings were gods. Also, the names were given at a coronation, but not at a birth announcement. Now, this is not talking about the coronation of a king. This is talking about the birth of a king. Some people have said, oh, Isaiah's writing about Hezekiah, and it's his birth announcement. But Hezekiah was born 3 years before Isaiah wrote this, so he's a bit late if it was for him. And also, when we look at these names, these are not normal names for a king. These are divine names. So, Wonderful Counselor. The literal meaning is a wonder of a counselor. So he's an amazing counselor, an amazingly wise person. Now, as we've seen from last week, the decisions of a king can make or break a kingdom. With Ahaz's poor decisions, he ruined his kingdom. Israel was crushed because of his poor decisions. And a kingdom that wants to be everlasting needs God's wisdom. He will carry out a program. And in chapter 11, it stresses more what this king will do. And just like Tirfan's work, this king will bring justice and peace to the oppressed. He will be a mighty, mighty God. This title is given to God himself. It's never given to a person. Isaiah is stressing the divine nature of this king. He's a divine warrior, an invincible champion of the oppressed. This king will have God's true might. He's an everlasting father. This points us to the concern, his concern for the helpless. He cares for his people. He disciplines his people and expects their loyal, reverential respect for him. He's an unfailing source of love and protection for them. He will bring peace to all mankind, peace between us and peace between us and God. You might think, well, how is this going to happen? Well, it tells us at the end of verse 7, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. A zeal is also fury and also used as a jealous God. I think for us today, jealousy tends to mean a petty, self-centered, unreasoning emotion. But that's not what this is. God being a jealous God. It's more of a sense that he's impatient with any opposition. He's a fierce champion of those he loves. As anyone in love knows, the stronger the love, the stronger the jealousy. It's a kind of concern that desires an exclusive place in somebody else's affections. Isaiah knew that God loved his people. He loved them so intensely that he would not rest until he had restored them to himself and given them the perfect king who could truly save them. God plans the future and keeps his promises. Israel's history had showed that time and time again they could not obey God. They could not love him and follow him. The only way for God to restore our relationship with him was for him to do it. And for Jesus to be the perfect king, to come, to live, and to die in our place. When the storms came for Israel, what was their response? What is our response? When we lose our job, when we get into debt, when our relationships fail, when we get ill, we have the same choice as Israel. We can look at the darkness, the hopelessness, the shattered dreams, and conclude that God has forgotten us. Or we can recall God's past mercies. We can remember his promises. Isaiah fixed his gaze on God and God's ability. He described the light and the joy filling God's people. He explained by remembering the past victories that God had performed. He remembered God's promises and fixed his gaze on this future hope that was so certain. He wrote about it as if it had already happened. He saw this fulfillment of hope in Jesus, the future ideal king. I wonder, where is our hope? Where is our gaze? I was really challenged last week by what Paul said when he was preaching. He said that Isaiah responded not with fear, the way people feared, but instead to only fear the Lord. I've been struggling with that this term. At the beginning of the year, I had a cyst removed from my face, and it was suspected that it might be skin cancer. I was afraid. And when I found out that I was okay, and it wasn't, I had this huge sense of relief. But then the doctor thought it might be another life-threatening condition. Again, I was afraid. And last week, I was challenged, why am I afraid? Am I trusting God? I decided to stop in the midst of that service and pray and ask God to help me. Help me to trust that he was with me no matter what happened, no matter what my results were. In the midst of the service, I felt a huge sense of relief. Even though I hadn't had any results back yet. The next day I went to the doctors and I got my results and I was clear, thankfully. But I'd had that sense of relief the day before. God had given me that sense of peace. Often I've found in my life anyway that when I decide to do something in spite of how I feel, the feelings catch up later on. When we choose to trust in the face of uncertainty, God will help us. That's the great thing. We choose to look at the light rather than the darkness. And the great thing is, it's not blind optimism. It's not, oh, it's okay, it's all going to be fine, we'll be fine. But it's a realization that the God that we serve is capable of so much. He is capable of touching our lives. He is capable of giving us strength. He is capable of giving us love in times of despair and hope and peace. There are many people sitting in this church who have much better stories to tell of how God's touched their life. And I think it'd be great, wouldn't it, after the service, if over coffee we just chatted to each other and said, how has God helped you? Maybe in our house groups or in our life groups, how has God worked in your life? And when we tell people, it reminds ourselves as well. It encourages us again. And when we hear other people's stories, it can really encourage and strengthen us. We're going to stop in a moment and listen to some music from Handel's Messiah. It kept going round and round in my head as I was reading this passage. And rather than sing it to you, I've got a recording of it. And the words are going to come up on the screen. I thought it'd be great to stop and take time to listen to God, to choose to hold on to one of these promises. This is for our future, but it's also for now. He is our wonderful counselor. He is our mighty God. He is our everlasting Father and Prince of Peace. He can bring us peace in the midst of darkness and chaos. And then we can be a light to the world as they see God's peace in us, unnatural in times of chaos. Let's be open to what God has to say. Let's be thankful for this truth. Maybe we need to step out this morning and claim this to be true in the midst of our darkness or the darkness that surrounds us. Let's stop and pray and listen together.